Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. I don't even think I know what that song is.
F This Movie.
That is beautiful. My name is Patrick and I'm joined by the musical styling of Mr. JB. How are you, sir?
Hello.
Welcome back to F This Movie. Tonight we're talking about The Graduate through a series of events and conversations. And I didn't want to talk about The Graduate because I was intimidated. But JB's like, let's do The Graduate. And I was like, no, it's old. And he's like, no, but let's do The Graduate. And I was like, oh, but it's boring. And he's like, no, let's do The Graduate. And then I realized I had been confusing The Graduate with Intolerance. So I apologize. The Graduate is a great idea. And so tonight we're talking about The Graduate. But before we do that, obviously, I have to remind everyone to visit our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
Please.
And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and find us in the iTunes store under F This Movie and blah, blah, blah. I'm sick of saying it.
Find us.
Resent the fact that I have to do it every week. I resent it.
We love email.
We do. And in fact, we're going to get to an email in just a couple minutes. But before we do, JB, have you seen anything good lately?
I have.
Done. Moving on.
Okay.
No. What have you seen?
I finally got to see 127 Hours. I think I'm the last person on Earth to see it.
I was the second to last.
I have a feeling that I liked it a lot more than you. I think because it was so much different than what I expected.
You know, and I call it 127 borings. Just kidding, it wasn't boring. It was aggressively not boring, actually.
I'm a big fan of James Franco.
Yeah, he's great.
And like what Danny Boyle did, if I had seen it before December 31st, it would have made my list of the 10 best of the year.
What would it have bumped off? Number 10?
Yeah, certainly.
What was your number 10?
Near the bottom.
Do you remember?
I don't have.
Was it Grown Ups?
We discussed this at the end of the summer, and
was it Piranha 3D?
Like Voldemort, Grown Ups is the film that shall not speak its name.
Was it Valentine's Day? That movie is romantic.
I just heard that they're making a sequel.
New Year's Eve.
Yes.
Yeah.
Imagine.
What a great idea.
Because people are always looking for a movie to see on New Year's Eve. I don't think the marketing strategy is going to work quite the same
way. No, and it totally worked on Valentine's Day because that movie made a boatload of money.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm amazed that no one did it before.
Yeah, Gary Marshall's a genius.
And on the long list of classic films that someone who's really into film should have seen long ago, but obviously life is short and there's always films that fall through the cracks, I finally saw The Sound of Music.
And?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect film. I recognize why it was so popular.
Nazis.
Yes, Nazis are always popular. Schindler's List, Sound of Music, the Blues Brothers. But it was interesting to watch.
Toy Story 3.
Yeah. What? And he saw the European cut.
That's right.
It was interesting to watch sort of through the lens of A, this was incredibly popular when it was released, and B, it was directed by Robert Wise, who also directed West Side Story.
Oh, right.
He co-directed it with Jerome Robbins, who had directed it on Broadway. But the saying goes, Robert Wise directed the film, Jerome Robbins did the choreography. And it's very interesting to compare those two films because they're actually a lot alike. What have you seen lately?
I, like you, I'm still trying to catch up on some of my Academy Award nominated films. So last night I went to see Inside Job, and it was very good, and made me very angry.
As well it should. And in the a first draft, we were talking about this on the underrated, overrated show.
Yeah.
And until I saw King's Speech, Inside Job was on my list of the 10 best of the year.
Yeah.
And again, I think there should be a channel on cable that shows it 24 hours a day so that everyone can see it and so that normal, ordinary people don't get taken again.
It's like having someone do stuff to you while you're asleep and then they show you a movie of what they did.
Yeah.
And you can't do anything about it because it's already been done and you know that they're going to get away with it.
And they're going to do it again.
Yep. That was the uplifting end of that movie. Spoilers, we're all effed.
The filmmaker was on Bill Maher.
Yeah, but he didn't talk. He barely said anything.
When he did, though, I got the feeling whenever someone goes on TV, even if it's cable, and like speaks the plain truth in ways that normal, ordinary people can understand it, that person is silenced. We don't want that to be on TV. And that's the feeling I got, because for the few seconds he was allowed to speak, he really sort of cut through the BS and was explaining things that Maher was asking about in a very level-headed, true way. And then the other two obnoxious contestants took over and monopolized the rest of the show.
And that was much of Inside Job, and I was fascinated by the idea. There was only one other guy in the theater. We were sitting a few rows apart, and we sort of took turns laughing in disbelief. It was always at different things. But I was fascinated by the fact that so many of these guys sat down for an interview with a filmmaker. I assume they had some idea what he wanted to talk about. And then when it came time to answer questions that they obviously didn't want to answer, they were unable to even convincingly lie. They just search for words and stumble and say nonsense. Like, I thought this was their job at this point, just lying about what they had done. But and it was very rewarding to see the one guy finally kind of lose his shit.
Yeah.
you've got 3 minutes. Give it your best shot. Like, oh, all right. Well, F you.
Roger Ebert said in his review that maybe one of the reasons why everything went south is that there were only 5 people on the planet who could actually explain the bundled securities the collateralized loss, liability, all that nonsense, that no one could understand what it really was.
Right.
So in the words of an earlier film, Enron, the smartest guys in the room, it becomes a black box. Money goes in and more money comes out and no one knows what's going on inside the black box. And if that's the case, this is Lewis Black. Sorry, I keep quoting people. If you can't explain what your company does to make a profit in 10 words or less, it's illegal. That's the test we should use.
Yeah, right, right. And a few of the people in the movie made the point that I liked when they talked about how it's everyone speaking in like these theoreticals and hypotheticals, and it's all ephemeral and it's all just made up stuff. They're not producing anything.
Exactly.
Anything.
Exactly. I make bicycles. Okay, you get to keep doing that. Right. That's legal.
Right.
I collateralize bundled mortgage risk loans amortization. You're going to jail. And that's the one thing that Ferguson got to say on Bill Maher before they shut him up. No one has been prosecuted for any of this.
Right. Yeah, they say that at the end of the movie, too.
So apparently, it's not illegal.
Many of them kept their jobs and or were promoted.
Yes.
And you mentioned the King's speech, which was on your 10 best list, and now, as of this recording, appears to be the front runner to, like, sweep the Oscars, basically.
It's going
to
pull off a Shakespeare in Love.
What are your feelings about that?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, and I think the Academy has a soft spot for something that's very traditional, that's very English, that has this very... I don't mean to disparage the film, but it's almost sort of a tapioca message the more you think about it, that the power of the English language and sort of this empty, uplifting feeling. I mean, I'm really glad that the character in the film got help, but I'm surprised because for the longest time I thought The Social Network was the front runner.
So did I.
For a whole bunch of other reasons. And I can't help thinking, and maybe I'm just being stubborn, I cannot fathom why Inception is not the front runner. It was so much more ambitious in what it was trying to do and succeeded in doing than any of the other 9 films. Is it that the fact that people are seeing it as this sort of overblown summer entertainment, that it's an action movie, that it's merely a thriller? I mean...
Yeah, to some extent, I think it came out too long ago and was forgotten.
Yeah.
I think there was a backlash against it. And I think, there's a large percentage of the voting population that doesn't think it's intellectual enough, which is funny because it's
very intellectual.
It's very intellectual, but
and it would be a proud,
there's too much action in it to be an intellectual movie, right?
It would be a proud addition to the pantheon of films that have won the Oscar. Certainly you can't get any worse than The Greatest Show on Earth and Gladiator. If they gave those two films the Oscar, I don't think they should worry about Inception not having enough right. intellectual content. Bottom line, though,
mm-hmm.
any of those three films win, I'm happy. But you also have to remind yourself, King's Speech has Harvey Weinstein behind it. And say what you want about Harvey. He really knows how yeah. to get his stuff nominated.
By,
I mean,
by
shuck a lot.
It to PG-13. Yeah, right.
Have they decided to do that?
I don't think so.
Because I remember when they did that for Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, I don't think that's official. The Cider House Rules, every year there was one of those that got in there, Finding Neverland. It's like, what? Finding yeah. Neverland? Are you kidding? And once again, you know, it's a 10-movie race that's essentially between two movies. So make it 5 movies, make it 10 movies, make it 50 movies. We're still only talking about, is it The Social Network or is it The King's Speech?
Right, and I forget what critic said this, but he suggested that once they expanded the race to 10, what you had then was the 5 that had a chance and the other 5.
The honorary nominees.
And the way to figure out the other 5 was to look at the nominations in the other categories.
Right.
And that would kind of
right.
give you a clue
right.
that I'm trying to think of the film of the 10 that has the least chance of winning.
I can barely remember the 10 that are nominated, but I don't think The Kids Are All Right will win Best Picture.
But I'm wondering if that's the least likely to win.
Winter's Bone might be even less likely.
Dark Horse. Toy Story 3, because I think most people will think, well, that might get the best animated film, and that's their consolation prize. I just can't imagine the third sequel ever winning an Oscar.
I don't know.
It's never happened.
I'm really surprised by this swing on The King's Speech. I knew Colin Firth would be nominated and will win, but I really thought things were leaning towards The Social Network and David Fincher for The Social Network. I have a big problem, and I'm sorry if this offends anyone who really loves The King's Speech, but I have a big problem with Tom Hooper winning Best Director. And again, I don't really have a big problem because the Oscars are meaningless.
And I do too. And when the nominations came out, I was amazed because show me a film that's more directed than Inception, a big production where it would have been very difficult to keep all the toy trains on the track.
It directed itself.
Apparently. but on the same note, and this is not to disparage Tom Hooper, because I really like The King's Speech.
Right.
I love The King's Speech. I love Social Network. I love
And
Inception.
That movie didn't direct itself. You know, I'm contradicting
Speech,
myself.
The King's Speech, though, is a stage play.
Yeah.
And presents far fewer challenges to a director than Inception, which had to keep multiple levels of
right.
action going
right.
in a very complicated concept and have everyone in the audience understand what was going on. Plus, he wrote it. But so much for sour grapes.
Anyway, let's talk about The Graduate, which kind of came about. We did a podcast a couple weeks ago on Garden State, and there were some references to The Graduate in Garden State, and obviously Garden State owes a lot to The Graduate. And so that's kind of how the idea for doing a show on The Graduate came about. But we had originally, the Garden State show came about because we got an email from a listener named Jeffrey Miller. And we did the Garden State show, and he wrote us a very nice email at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com talking about Garden State. But I want to read a little bit of his email because he asks a question that I want to pose to you. He talked about Garden State for a little while, and he says, I don't want to turn this into a novel. One more thing about Garden State. I think it's a great example of a perfect storm-type movie-going experience, one where George Clooney drowns. No, I mean one where I experienced the perfect film at the perfect time in my life. The 1-2 punch of Lost in Translation and Garden State in my first years of college were amazing and moving film-going experiences for me. Even though I was probably slightly younger than the target demographic for those movies, they'll always be important to me whether they hold up or not. Do you guys have any perfect movie-going experiences? Not necessarily films you saw in the theater, but films you saw at the perfect time in your life. And JB, I pose that question
and
to
you.
And
that's a great question, Jeff, and I appreciate the email. Interestingly enough, he mentions that he was younger than the target demographic for both of those films.
Yeah.
And listening to the question and thinking about it, I think I have two. And that applies to me in both cases. I am amazed when I think back. One of those films for me was Annie Hall.
Okay.
I had never seen a movie like that before for a number of reasons. I responded to it. I loved it. And that came out in 77, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was 15. Looking back, I cannot believe that I got out of that film what I got out of that film.
Yeah.
And I was a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
And I'm not patting myself on the back. I was buku sophisticated. Because I don't think I was. But I really responded to that film as an older viewer. And an even bigger example of that, this thing that Jeff is talking about, is the movie that we're going to talk about tonight, The Graduate. I wrote about this in my thankful list for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That I was very young, and I was at a point in my life where things were not going well. And I caught The Graduate on the CBS Wednesday night movie. And it was transformative. I think about it almost like popular music, that when you're growing up, there are certain songs that cement themselves into your brain, and you sort of carry them with you throughout your whole life. And I think movies do that too, in a very special way. And there are some movies that are so close to our hearts that we remember ourselves when we first saw them. And the interesting thing about that, and I think even more so than music, is as we grow older, we will probably return to the movie again and again and again because we get something out of it. But the movie doesn't change.
Right.
We change.
Right.
And in watching the movie, it becomes a mirror reflecting you watching it. So when I'm in sixth grade, and I was in sixth grade when I first watched The Graduate, what does an 11-year-old have in common with Benjamin Braddock? Well, in my case, a lot. And then I watched it again when I was in college. And then I started teaching film study, and for about 15 years, I showed it every semester and found that my students responded to it as well, even though they weren't certainly the target demographic, that it was a film that was 20 years old and then 30 years old. And watching it again for the podcast, I had the very interesting reaction, because I hadn't watched it in a while, that I am no longer Ben. I can no longer be Ben. And that there's a scene in the film.
Are you Mrs. Robinson?
Thankfully, no.
Are you Mr. Robinson?
No. Oh, he's awful.
He won't close the beaches.
You're getting to it much more succinctly. Murray Hamilton's a great actor.
Yeah.
And between Mr. Robinson and the Mayor of Amity, those are two terrific performances. There's a scene where Benjamin has graduated from college and he's spending some time at home and he sort of becomes aimless and he likes to drift around in the pool. And there's a scene where his father confronts
him. You're William Daniels?
Yeah. That I'm at a stage in my life where he's saying, do you mind telling me what all that very hard work was for? And Dustin Hoffman says, you got me. I think it's a very good thing that after a young person does some very good work, that they would want to laze around a little bit and sit in a pool and drink beer. But I would think that after a couple weeks, that person would want to take stock of themselves. And when I urge my son to get a summer job, just so that he has something to do, I am William Daniels, and I have come full circle with this film. I still hold it close to my heart, though.
It's an unbelievably great movie, and I will say that when JB suggested we do The Graduate for the podcast, I was somewhat resistant to it, and only because what I kept telling him was that I'm intimidated by the movie. I hold the movie very close, and not to once again invoke something that we say a lot on the show, I didn't want it to be the Chris Farley show, but I also feel like more than, say, Ghostbusters, which I also love and we did a podcast on, that The Graduate has almost more to unpack than I can deal with on a podcast.
True, and again, I find this very useful shorthand. We don't want anything to turn into the Chris Farley show.
So and by that, maybe we don't want to overdose on drugs and die.
Well, I don't. I can't speak for you. That that maybe this one will be a little bit more laid back because we hold this film very close to our heart. So one thing I wanted to point out, because Patrick and Doug mentioned this in the Garden State podcast, that suddenly in the last 10 or 15 years with sort of quirky indie films, you get this phenomenon where everything has to be independent film stylized, and everything has to be quirky in a certain way. And so I'm paraphrasing the two of you poorly.
Okay. It was probably me. Doug rarely says anything intelligent.
That you get films that are full of shit, for lack of a better term. But what I mean by that is they are full of twee nonsense that has nothing to do with reality, and they're simply there to add a quirk factor.
Right.
And as I watched The Graduate again for this podcast, I gave it tremendous credit for having none of that whatsoever. And having the courage to be still at times and let the audience decide what was going on and what was going through the characters' minds and emotions, and that the filmmakers gave the audience credit for being able to figure it out without the endless narration over-explanation.
Right, characters saying exactly what they're thinking. Even worse, one character telling another character what he's thinking.
There are scenes in this film that are nearly wordless. Mm-hmm. And they're some of the most affecting scenes in the film. Mm-hmm. And I wish filmmakers today gave the audience that much credit. Last night as we were watching again, my wife commented that Mike Nichols loves Dustin Hoffman's face. Mm-hmm. Because there are shots when we just consider his face at different stages in the film. And we're watching him think.
And that's Dustin Hoffman's face, when you think about it, rarely changes throughout the movie. I mean, it's almost always the same expression, and yet you know that there's always something different going on behind his face. You know what I mean? Like that same expression reads so many different ways given what's happening in the movie.
And part of that might have been calculated, and part of that, not to take any credit away from the film, might be one of the reasons why we hold it in such high esteem, because we were so able to place ourselves into that situation, or at least to identify with him.
I don't know if I have this right. Was it Dustin Hoffman who did a screen test? I know his screen test was sort of legendarily disastrous, and people had a big problem with it, and then when they watched back the film, do I have this right? That it looked like he wasn't doing anything. And then they went and watched the film of the screen test, and, oh, look, he's actually doing a lot. It's just very subtle, and it doesn't read until you're watching it on film. I don't know if I have that story right, but I want to say it was Dustin Hoffman for The Graduate, and that makes sense.
I've read that story, too, and if I can send our listeners to the library.
Library. It's pronounced library.
I'm sorry. I believe it's Pictures at a Revolution.
Yes.
Where there is a chapter-long, detailed production history of The Graduate that's very entertaining to read. And boy, is that Mark Harris?
Yeah.
That he really did his homework. I mean, the whole book is great. The Graduate chapter is a particular.
And again, we don't want to get too much into that book, but what a fascinating study. If you look at The Graduate, where that movie's at and where Dr. Doolittle was at, you know, in the same year. And the movie, if you don't know, or the book, rather, if you don't know, it's just sort of a study of the five films nominated for Best Picture in 1960. That would have been 68, but the films were from 67. And it's just about sort of the change that happened at that time, where you have movies like Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate versus Dr. Doolittle and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
And In the Heat of the Night,
which won.
Which, of course, won.
Right. And it's a great, great book. And I was reading up a little bit in preparation for the podcast, and I read Roger Ebert's review of the 30th anniversary release of The Graduate.
Yeah.
And he kind of pans it
and
says it doesn't hold up at all. And I could not disagree more with that.
And I read that as well, because besides Bonnie and Clyde, Ebert originally made a name for himself being one of the first critics to say, this is something really special. Mm-hmm. It was with Bonnie and Clyde, and it was with The Graduate.
Except for those songs by Simon and Garfunkel. His 67 review singles those out as being something in the movie that doesn't work.
And oddly enough, that is the biggest problem that my students used to have with the film. And part of it, of course, is whenever a teacher of any age does anything with music, it's not the music that the kids listen to at home, and so there's an automatic reaction to it. But year after year, and these are kids who love the film and responded to it, they were very put off by how many times The Sound of Silence is repeated.
That's crazy.
Well, I agree, and I remember reading that Mike Nichols was making the film and listening to Simon and Garfunkel music, and he sort of fell in love with these songs and decided to use them. And maybe this is just me extrapolating, but one of the scenes that we should talk about in the film, because I'm fond of saying that this film, which you should all buy, is film school on a DVD. You can teach yourself to make movies by watching this film. And actually, I found very little of it comes across as film school-y.
Well,
I think it still works.
And that's what I was going to jump in when you were talking about, like, let's say Garden State, a movie that's filled with twee eccentricity and it's, you know, full of shit. And again, I like Garden State, but it is full of shit. And The Graduate has none of that. And yet it's a movie that's incredibly stylized, and he's always doing something.
There's a lot of camera tricks.
A lot, but I think part of that is what has kept, I mean, it doesn't date the movie at all. I think the movie still feels really contemporary.
I agree. And one thing that makes it that way, one thing I've always said is, and I often say this about Rebel Without a Cause, if you get films that are old, the hairstyles and the clothing has a lot to do with the way that you're going to react to it. And that's why early 70s films don't come across very well.
Right.
As long as the hair is short and the clothes don't draw attention to themselves, it dates far better than something like Carrie.
Right.
Just to grab one. So we're talking about this scene that I think is really the centerpiece of the film. It's a beautiful piece of filmmaking where Mike Nichols wants to suggest these sort of wasted weeks of Benjamin. He doesn't know what to do with himself. He falls into this affair. And so we literally see him sort of sleepwalking through his life. And the central figure of Benjamin cuts through time and space. And we see him walking in a way that he's disrupting the architecture of the house. He's interrupting the architecture of time. He's in his bedroom. No, he's in the hotel. No, he's in the pool. And it's just an amazing piece of filmmaking, which of course climaxes, pardon the pun, with this wonderful joke where he jumps onto an inflatable raft and through the magic of editing, he's no longer on the raft. And during that sequence, we hear The Sound of Silence for the second time. And the sequence keeps going. And The Sound of Silence ends. And there's a short pause, and another Simon and Garfunkel song starts up, which is perfectly appropriate to the end of that sequence. And every time I watch the film, it reminds me of listening to an album.
Yeah, right, right.
The song ends, and the next song comes up, and it reminds me of all these stories of Mike Nichols listening to Simon and Garfunkel songs and falling in love with them, and him just saying in the editing room, "Oh, just let the album play." But I'm sure there's more thought that went into it than that. But
I don't know.
Really works.
I mean, there may have been more thought that went into it than that. But here's something fascinating that I just learned today. I listened to, on the DVD, there's a commentary track from Mike Nichols and Steven Soderbergh. And they do a commentary on Catch-22 also, which is great. And I really like that movie. And they do one on The Graduate. And it's great as well. They get to the end of the movie, and Mike Nichols confesses, I guess, sort of, that that last shot of them on the bus, they were really just supposed to be laughing and sort of joyous, but he had so put the fear of God into them that they couldn't mess up the take because they were on this bus and they couldn't have it for any longer and they needed to get it right. He freaked them out so bad that that's what's reading on their faces. Their like fear of him basically. And he ended up using that in the movie and it's perfect. And it changes the movie.
Everyone comments on
it. It changes the movie. And it was an accident of sorts. So those things are possible.
There are many happy accidents.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert once said, and I think he was quoting someone else, but I can't remember who he was quoting, that the definition of a great movie is a movie with three great scenes and no bad scenes. And that's a hell of a definition. Yeah. I've carried that definition with me. So I'm watching The Graduate for what is perhaps the 30th or 40th time, and I'm thinking about Ebert's definition. And here's another reason why I think both of us like The Graduate so much. The Graduate, my friend, is not only a movie with no bad scenes, it's a movie with 10 great scenes.
At least.
There are 10.
Okay, you great actually counted?
I did.
I would say there's more than 10. But.
I would say, spoiler alert, well, I didn't count little ones that are sort of transitions.
Okay.
And I know my wife made a case for one that we hold very close to our heart, but I think that's quirky and that's just us.
What's the scene?
We'll get to that in a second.
All right.
You
don't have to say spoiler. This is the oldest movie we've ever done on F This Movie, and if you haven't seen The Graduate, shame on you. It's 2011.
I'm using shorthand, and a lot of these scenes are really famous, like AFI's 100 Most Famous Lines. Graduate, by the way, made a lot of AFI lists.
Yeah, I saw
that. Best movie, best, one of the best movies, one of the best comedies, the best lines, I think best villain one year.
Really?
Yeah. So, in no particular order, here are The Graduate's 10 great scenes. Plastics.
Okay.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
Yes.
Aren't you? The entire hotel room conversation, which is like a mini play where he wants to talk first.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we get The Leg, which became the iconic album cover.
Right.
The montage that I just made reference to.
Yep.
Benjamin sleepwalks through his life, and we have editing tricks out the window that are beautiful. His 21st birthday present, the scuba suit.
Absolutely.
Which
are
actually,
You Ready? Feature attraction, which always makes me laugh. I don't know why. Just, Are You Ready? Feature attraction. Makes
and
me
I
laugh
love William Daniels.
Yeah.
And I wonder how William Daniels and Elizabeth Wilson, two of the waspiest people on earth, William Daniels played John Adams in 1776, gave birth to Dustin Hoffman.
Well, it was supposed to be Robert Redford.
Yes. Who, interestingly enough, boy, what a tangent. In the film, Elaine has another boyfriend that she kind of promised she would marry, Carl.
It's Robert Redford.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's an accident.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Are You Here for an Affair? That old sequence.
Yes. That cracks me up. That cracks
me up. Oh, yes. The Singleman party. I just have a toothbrush. How he signs the card and then folds it. And the pocket isn't a pocket, and there's no way to get rid of the card because he's written his real name. That's a great scene. The zoo scene where he looks at the monkey.
Yeah.
Do not tease.
Yeah.
And there's that byplay. The entire chase of him trying to get to the hospital, including, and I know Wayne's World made fun of this, when he stops at the gas station, he makes the frenzied phone call, he's getting the directions from the guy, and the guy... the gas station attendant hesitates in his direction, and Dustin Hoffman slaps the counter, and there's a perfect musical sting because there's just this sort of chick, chick, chick guitar thing going on.
Paul Simon was recording that live as he watched it.
Really?
He synced it up. Yeah, he was sitting there basically scoring the movie.
I did not know that. And, of course, the attendants, don't you want some gas, Father, which, of course, becomes tremendously significant. The entire scene in the church.
Yeah.
And the last shot on the bus.
Yeah.
That's my 10.
You left out the sequence in the rain, where you get that shot of...
Goodbye, Benjamin.
Of Mrs. Robinson. I mean, that's unbelievable. I would say the scene between Benjamin and Mr. Robinson, I think, is pretty great.
There's and, two.
The last one.
Oh, you are scum.
Yeah.
I think you're a degenerate.
Yeah.
That's not saying a lot about my wife now, is it? You'll pardon me if I don't shake hands. Murray Hamilton's a stitch. So that makes 12. And before we leave the church, I'm watching the film again. And recently on Slate, there was a review of Broadcast News, which just came out on Blu-ray.
Yes.
And the author was comparing Broadcast News, a groundbreaking, wonderful romantic comedy, with James L. Brooks' more recent How Do You Know? And that... On the audio commentary for Broadcast News, James L. Brooks said, I don't know if they'd let me do that anymore. I don't think they'd let me end a movie like this, because in Brooks's words, people go to a movie, they want a movie ending.
Right.
And I read that on Slate, and I thought about John Carpenter in that documentary I'm so fond of, The American Nightmare. He's talking about Halloween, one of the most successful horror films ever made. And he says, I don't think they'd let me do that anymore. So I'm watching The Graduate again, and I'm watching that amazing sequence in the church, and I'm so tired of compromised, stupid, romantic comedy endings. You have to give this film credit. This film has one of the ballsiest endings ever.
Yeah.
And it's 2011.
Yeah.
And if anything, it seems more ballsy. They said I do. She's married.
Right.
So we have Benjamin attacking the father of the bride, giving him a little elbow to the kidneys and taking him out. Mrs. Robinson is slapping the shit out of Elaine. And Dustin Hoffman takes the cross, uses it as a weapon, and then uses it to bar the door. I mean, my God!
Yeah.
Talk about something they would not let you do today. And here's my proof. Halftime show.
No one ever lets me beat them with a cross.
Super Bowl.
Yes.
Black Eyed Peas are performing.
Great.
They did a duet with Usher.
Yes.
I didn't know this until after because I don't keep up with popular music. The song is called Oh My God.
Yes.
During the Super Bowl halftime show, they
really
changed
it to
Oh My Gosh.
You know, I wasn't paying attention.
And I sat there and I said,
barf.
People would be offended by just saying the, what the hell? Where have we, how
it's
have
not,
we
it's
come
not, it's
to
not
this?
Just, it's not the saying of God, it's that a black guy is saying it.
Oh, Janet Jackson, what hath ye wrought? But I think for anyone who might dismiss The Graduate and say, oh, that's from the 60s, we have an ending that, again, to paraphrase James L. Brooks and John Carpenter, you might not be able to get away with today in a mainstream Hollywood film.
And there's two things that I want to jump back to. One, obviously that last shot of them on the bus and just everything is very uncertain and what the hell did we just do is something that has been imitated a few times, I think. Other movies have sort of ripped that movie off, including most recently, I would say, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I feel like that ending owes a lot to The Graduate. And I think in a lot of ways, actually, Scott Pilgrim owes a lot to The Graduate. Not to jump on a different topic, but you know, The Graduate was sort of very held up, especially in 67, as like, this is a movie about the generation gap, and this is the movie that defines sort of young people versus their parents. And Rebel Without a Cause had sort of done that before, and I think there's been a few movies since that have sort of done something like that, and I almost think Scott Pilgrim versus the World, while not being about that in the way that The Graduate might be, I think is definitely a movie that is sort of a dividing line, and I don't think it's being recognized as that yet, but I think it will be in the future. But again, on that commentary, Mike Nichols, I think it's on the commentary, says they never gave any thought to the generation gap. That's not what the movie's about at all to him. That was not anything he intended.
Well, that's interesting, because this time when I rewatched it, and of course that final shot has just been analyzed to death, that it's not this complete celebration of nonconformity, that at the end both of them get looks on their faces, especially her. And again, if you say it wasn't intentional, that she was just afraid that she was screwing up the shot for Nichols, that clearly once the Elaine character has done this, she can never go back to her parents.
Right.
That's the decision she's just made.
Right.
But the other thing I was thinking as I watched it the other night was that throughout the film, and this is one of the first lines, I was worried about my future. The father says, well, what are you worried about? Well, I wanted it to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the film, once he falls in love with Elaine, the object for him when he finally stops being passive and starts being active about things is to get her to marry him. So I'm watching the last scene. They're on the bus. Their faces suddenly get very sober, and they look like they're realizing something. And then we get the famous cutaway to the other people on the bus, who I think noticeably look old and haggard. It looks like life has just drained them of all life. And I thought, and I wondered if Nichols meant the sort of, I don't even know what to call it, that if Dustin Hoffman wanted his life to be different, then this coup that he's just pulled off is the first step to him and Elaine getting married, which is actively seeking out the life that his parents had.
Right.
So you're running away from them by doing exactly what they did.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's a dichotomy that's been discussed before.
No, I don't feel like it has. I think that's a very
because I think young people tend to define themselves against their parents. I'm not going to be like them.
Right.
And then you wind up becoming your parents.
Right.
Mel Brooks once said this: "We mock the thing we are to be. We mock the thing we are to be." And I still remember, I think it was when I turned 40, I thought, I always had so many big disagreements with my father, and yet I have built myself a life around myself that was just like his.
Yeah. I didn't know that people read that ending as a celebration of nonconformity. I've never seen it that way.
Just for a second, just now, I thought you were going to say, I didn't know you had a father. That people were looking at the ending as what?
As a celebration of nonconformity, as you said a few minutes ago.
Oh, no. I think most of the young people who went to see this film...
That's fascinating.
...in 1967, because look at the way... I mean, you're looking at the way he pulled it off.
Right, I guess.
Which is so unconventional.
Yeah.
But what is more conventional for a comedy to end with the two that we like pairing off?
Right.
I don't know. I think it's something worth thinking about.
You had said when you were talking about James L. Brooks and John Carpenter that both sort of go back to this idea of, I don't think they would let me do this anymore. And so is it the they that I have a problem with? Because so many directors that I once loved or who once were making great films, I believe that they lose it eventually. They lose the ability to make those great films. Not all of them, but many of them. But maybe it's not them. Maybe it's the they. Because I was thinking about Mike Nichols as I'm watching The Graduate. This is a perfect movie. This is a movie that it ended and I was tempted to start it again. I wanted to sit through it again. And I love Catch-22 and I really love Carnal Knowledge. And he was great. And then I think about, you know, What Planet Are You From, and Wolf, and Closer, and...
the one I always point to is Day of the Dolphin.
Okay.
Which
that's way sooner than... I mean, I was at least in the 2000s.
Well, no, I mean, that was the beginning of...
Right, right.
And I got the feeling that he sort of gave up on movies and went back to the theater, where he's had certainly more success. I thought he did an admirable job on Spamalot. I mean, turning that into something that was watchable, and I think before Spamalot there was another show for which he won acclaim, or could that have been Closer on Broadway? That started as...
Did he do Angels in America on Broadway, or just the movie?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, part of it is when you're young, you're hungry for success, and you're a little bit more willing to experiment, but it might be a case of, I've always heard that if you're in a band, you have your entire life to make your first album, and then you have 3 months to make your second.
Yeah, maybe.
Two more quick points. And this shows what happens when you watch a movie a lot over a long period of time. You start to appreciate and love tiny details. You start to obsess over tiny details. At the beginning of this film, Benjamin is in his room, and his parents are throwing him a party to celebrate his graduation. And they're upset that he's sort of holed up in his room, and they want him to come down and mingle with their friends. And as they go through the hallway on the second floor, they pass a picture. It's a picture of a clown, a very unhappy clown. And the camera lingers on it, so I have to think it's there for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think it's meant to be symbolic of Benjamin, that he's unhappy, that he's this the figure of ridicule or something. And I think if you were to write a master's thesis on The Graduate, you should call it The Unhappy Clown. And what I compare this to, because again, I used to show The Graduate every semester in film study class, so I've seen it dozens of times, is there is a shot you probably don't remember in the original Psycho, when Vera Miles, as Lila Crane, winds up in Norman's bedroom, and it's full of odd things, including a stuffed rabbit, who looks very unhappy. I call that the unhappy bunny. And if I ever wrote anything about Psycho and not wanting to copy the hundreds of other things that have been written about Psycho, I would call it the unhappy bunny.
Nice.
So we're looking at two BFI monographs.
Okay.
The unhappy bunny, Alfred Hitchcock Psycho, and the unhappy clown, Mike Nichols The Graduate.
You could have a whole unhappy series. And you could do one about grown-ups, and you could call it The Unhappy JB.
The Unhappy Viewer. The Unhappy Movie Theater Customer Demanding a Refund. The Unhappy Podcast People Thinking It Would Be More Fun to Make Fun of That Movie and Discovering at the End of the Summer It Really Isn't Any Fun at All.
Yeah.
One final point, and this speaks to perhaps how more current and contemporary generations react to the film. I wanted to read the Wikipedia entry for The Graduate, just to see what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it contains this exhausting plot summary.
Which is mostly what Wikipedia is.
And then some little tidbits about the film that weren't very helpful. Although they did mention that Ebert trumped the film. He really went to bat for it. And then the 30th anniversary, he didn't think it held up. So I learned that from Wikipedia.
He doesn't like Benjamin. Benjamin's not interesting.
But the thing I took away from the Wikipedia entry was perhaps more proof that I'm not 20 anymore. After Elaine learns the truth of Benjamin's affair,
mm-hmm.
And she goes back to Berkeley, Benjamin decides that he wants to pursue her. He is shown watching her, leaving her house, going back to Berkeley, and then on the Berkeley campus, he's looking at her. And on the Wikipedia plot summary, they explicitly stated Benjamin begins stalking her.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting. Because as I watched the film with that idea planted in my mind,
right.
You can't interpret it any other way. But until that idea was put in my head, I never considered what he was doing to be stalking.
Right. And is that just a function of we like this character and we're on his side and therefore we are just reading it as he's persistent, and because we want him to, you know, typically when you're thinking about a stalker, you're on the side of the victim.
Right.
We're concerned about Catherine Ross. We're not rooting for Benjamin.
And clearly, once she knows that he's on the Berkeley campus, I'm just sitting in on classes. They've been very congenial about it. If she continued to rebuke him, we would start interpreting behavior very differently.
Right.
As it stands, though, maybe because that whole ethos of the stalker really didn't exist in the 60s, especially in terms of romantic comedies, all of that behavior of him watching her and him following her to Berkeley, I thought was set up for one of, I think, the funnier jokes in the film, when he finally jumps on the bus after following her for weeks and says, "Isn't this a coincidence?" I mean, that's a very, very funny joke. But, again, until I read the Wikipedia entry, I never saw that as stalking.
I never have, and I still won't, I don't think. And maybe that's just me being in denial. But, you know, I don't know. And to some extent, like, because she kind of knows that he's there, so is that stalking? I mean, it is, right? It still is stalking. But it's like an unspoken agreement they have, almost. That.
And going from the stalking angle, I have one question to ask you.
I wish more of your sentences started with, going from the stalking angle.
When the police come to your house.
Can you develop this film for me?
Does this rag smell like chloroform to you? Elaine is made aware that Benjamin is in Berkeley. And she goes to the rooming house where he's living. Brief tangent. There are actors in this film who have parts that are so tiny. And yet Nichols allows every single one of them to distinguish themselves. And I think that's the writing. Buck Henry obviously gives himself the plum role of the desk clerk. But Norman Fell is in this movie for about 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's not just his dialogue. It's that weird noise he makes when he climbs the steps that makes you wonder for his health. His obsession with outside agit. I mean, it's really a wonderful performance. Elaine goes to Benjamin's rooming house and confronts him with what she has heard is the truth.
Right.
He disputes that emphatically, and she winds up screaming.
Right.
She then leaves because he's been kicked out of the house, and he says he just wants to pack. Later, we don't know how much time has elapsed. She shows up in what I'm taking to be the middle of the night and says, "Benjamin, will you kiss me?"
Mm-hmm.
In the film, I have to say it works. It works wonderfully and organically.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I thought about it, are the filmmakers asking us to believe that this happens because that could happen in real life? People reassess things and change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Given what the Elaine character's been told, it seems like a major, I mean, it's a very...
Right.
But I buy it, and it doesn't stop me short. It's a really nice scene for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
He kisses her and then yawns.
This movie made me sad that Dustin Hoffman didn't play more comedy. I mean, obviously he's very famous for Tootsie, and that's a comedy, but he really did more dramatic stuff, and he's incredibly funny in the movie. I think the scene works almost because, again, what you were speaking to earlier, which is that we are able to fill in so much. And even Anne Bancroft, who is not a part of that scene, but who is very much a part of that scene,
yes,
because we know her and we understand that Elaine knows her, we see how she comes to that conclusion.
And that's exactly what my wife said. She has been told one thing. Dustin Hoffman has told her another. She has two truths from which to choose. And she knows her mother well enough to know that Benjamin's telling the truth.
Right. And to some extent, you know, wants to believe Benjamin as well. Because she does like him, you know, and doesn't necessarily believe that he's capable of that. I mean, look how quickly she forgives him for the way he treats her on that horrible date, you know.
I would say one of the most horrible dates in film history.
Taxi Driver.
Well, those two scenes are very similar, but
because Taxi Driver, he doesn't know what he's doing. Benjamin does.
Whenever I watch this film, I never stop being mortified and feeling bad for her.
Can I tell you the truth? I have this weird thing where
it's so humiliating
when something makes me uncomfortable, like on a TV show or something, or where I'm embarrassed for a person on a show, I either have to leave the room or change the channel. And that's become shorthand with me and my wife, where I say, I want to change the channel. It's a situation I have to get out of. I can't watch this anymore. Watching The Graduate again, I had to fast forward a little bit through that scene.
Because this shows how talented the filmmakers are, because normally a scene of a stripper doing something like that.
Right. That's the part I skip.
It would have my complete attention, and it would be something that I would very much enjoy watching. But it is so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Although I still laugh when Dustin Hoffman says, you're missing a great effect here. Can you do it? I mean, that is just the most awful thing said
ever. Yeah, it really is. It really is horrible. I was thinking about, you know, and again, I don't necessarily think of The Graduate as a romantic comedy, even though it is essentially a romantic comedy. But because that phrase has just been brought down by so much horrible baggage,
especially in the last couple of years.
Right, and I just was thinking about how... what was the scene?
I've said this to my students in the last 2.5 years many, many times, every time I get duped into going seeing another one. Hollywood needs to stop making romantic comedies. For about 5 years, there needs to be a moratorium until they learn how to make them again.
Yeah. It was the scene, I think, when Benjamin and Mrs. Robinson have the big fight in the hotel room, and they're not going to sleep together, and then they talk a little bit more, and he starts to take his clothes off again, and he decides. And I just thought, wow, here are people who have a discussion, who change their minds about things, who they're, every character in the film is like a fully realized human being, is complicated, and who has
an inner life,
yes,
that's not dictated by a story arc,
right, and has emotions that conflict with one another, and we're allowed to see that and watch that play out. And when you compare that to exactly what you just said, the contemporary romantic comedy, which is just
by the numbers. Gee, you think they'll get together? Gee, you think they'll stop that train?
And it's not even that the ending is predictable. It's the way that they get there, where it's just no one is a human being. They're just a function of a screenplay. I'm the boy, and I'm the girl.
And think about the scene that you just brought up, the scene that we mentioned before. It's probably one of the longer scenes in the film, this hotel room fight, which begins with Benjamin turning on the light and saying, Mrs. Robinson, do you think we can say a few words first? And the scene goes along, and there's a lot of changes and changes in mood and changes in tone. In fact, at one point, she takes him by the hair and says, "Don't you ever." And think about how that scene ends. Let's not say anything. It's really... And that's another thing, that change in tone that really isn't allowed anymore.
Right.
But oddly enough, in a film like The Dilemma, you have lots of changes in tone that were that had to be unplanned that make you sit there and go, what is this?
Right. And in something like The Dilemma, you feel like it's because the changes in tone are on different color pages in the screenplay. It's been touched by all these hands who say it needs to be this, no, it needs to be this, and they have different writers adding different things, and they shoot what's there, and then they don't realize, oh, none of this coheres at all.
And we have this film that seems to be, I don't want to rehash The Dilemma, but we have this film that almost seems to be a drama, and yet Vince Vaughn keeps getting beat up, and that's supposed to be funny. And then Queen Latifah shows up playing a character from another film, and that's supposed to be funny.
Right.
But on the other hand, Vince Vaughn has a gambling problem, hilarious in any country, and Kevin James is literally working himself to death, and I don't know how to reconcile the different pieces of the film.
Right.
And yet there's a way to do it, because as we're saying, The Graduate does that repeatedly throughout the film and pulls it off.
And in that instance, you know that it's the intent of the people behind it, of Buck Henry and of Mike Nichols, that they knew exactly what they were doing and structured their film this way, versus something like The Dilemma, which is just this sort of mishmash of all these different things. You know what I mean? That's just
and maybe part
a product.
Of it is The Dilemma was written for the screen, and The Graduate was based on a book.
Right.
The final thing I learned from Wikipedia, Charles Webb, who wrote the original novel,
yes,
signed some sort of deal where if he ever wrote a sequel, there was some financial thing that was tied to the movie company. And once the movie The Graduate took off, he became very upset that perhaps he didn't see all the riches from that because of the deal he signed.
Not only did he not see riches, he's like utterly destitute, like homeless.
Right. And because he doesn't want the movie entity who now owns The Graduate to profit further from his work, he has written a sequel. It's called Homeschool. It hasn't been published in the United States because he has this problem with whoever owns.
Right.
I guess it's MGM now. Or
well, they have the rights to home video.
Right.
Samuel Bayer, maybe?
That it's been published in France. It hasn't been published in the United States. I'd love to read it.
Yeah, right.
I can only imagine what it would be about, because, of course, at the beginning of The Player, we get that hilarious scene where Buck Henry is pitching a sequel to The Graduate, and what is it he says? Oh, Mrs. Robinson has had a stroke.
Right.
There's your movie.
Yeah, I have a feeling that no good can come from a sequel to The Graduate, that it would be... I'm trying to think of a compare. Texasville.
A few years
Remember
ago,
Texasville?
Wasn't there a film where Jennifer Aniston finds out?
Rumor has it.
Yeah, that the real life exploits of her parents were the basis of. I never saw it.
Oh God, Rob Reiner needs to stop making movies for a long time.
I forgot that was him.
Oh, it's so sad. The AV Club, I believe, has redubbed Rumor Has It. Everybody fucks Kevin Costner. So,
okay, then.
The Graduate, they turned into a stage play.
Yes, which has had great success with sort of a rotating cast of people who other people would want to go see in a play. On Broadway, it was Kathleen Turner and Jason Biggs.
Neither of whom I want to see in those roles.
But I think in some cases, when it's on Broadway, the fact that the person is a movie or TV star is a draw.
It absolutely is, but I brought it up because I was thinking about Jason Biggs. Like, I understand why someone would say, oh, he's kind of like young Dustin Hoffman, only no, he isn't.
No, not at all.
And I don't want to see him, and I don't think any of the... I saw Lorraine Bracco and Jerry Hall, and there was a list of people who had played Mrs. Robinson, and I don't suspect any of them could come close to Anne Bancroft.
It's a money bonanza for older actresses.
Right. All right, I guess we are done talking about The Graduate.
If you've never seen The Graduate, see it. I'd like to think that it still speaks to young people. I hope it can still speak to young people.
I think it does.
In about 6 months, I'm going to add it back to my curriculum and do the bold experiment and see if it still does. So next fall, I'll know.
Okay, great. All right, I guess that's it then. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com if you have ideas for shows or if you have comments about the show. Sometimes we read them, as we did. It got us into a discussion about The Graduate.
Do, 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 do. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to F this movie again. Because Patrick Bromelidi. Dee, 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 dee. Okay, fine.